Welcome to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts Bob Dancer and Richard W. Munchkin. Bob Dancer is America's premier video poker writer and teacher. He's in the Video Poker Hall of Fame, and he's written 10 books about video poker, including Video Poker for the Intelligent Beginner and the best-selling Million Dollar Video Poker. He helped develop the Video Poker for Winners computer software. Richard W. Munchkin has played blackjack, backgammon, and poker professionally, and is in the Blackjack Hall of Fame. His book, Gambling Wizards, Conversations with the World's Greatest Gamblers, is a testament to the many ways you can succeed at gambling. The goal of the show is that, by listening, you'll be a more knowledgeable gambler tomorrow than you were yesterday. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good evening. Welcome. I'm Bob Dancer in studio, and Richard Munchkin is here via telephone from California. Hello, Munchkin.
Good evening, Bob.
All right, we're back. Our guest tonight is going to be Michael Koenig, and we're going to be speaking about his book, The Man with the $100,000 Breast. I've always admired authors who can come up with super titles that almost force you to read the book to find out what the heck it's all about. This title qualifies. The closest I ever got was a story in Casino Player, which asks the question, is a royal flush better than sex? I never answered the question, but I did like the question. So, Mike was on our first show and talking about his book, Smart Money. Since Munchkin wasn't part of the broadcast team back then, he might sneak in some questions about that book tonight in addition to the tonight's book.
Sure. It's all gambling. It's all good.
All right. So my first question is, where is Fezzik when we need him? Our guest last week was premier sports handicapper Steve Fezzik, and 2 days after he was on the show, there was a very strange situation in the USC-Utah football game where I would love to have Fezzik's comments. Utah was trailing by 3 points, 17-14, and on the very last play of the game, they were going to try a field goal to tie it up. Didn't really matter whether it made it or not. SC was favored by 8.5 points, so didn't really matter. Except the field goal was blocked by USC, and their guy picked it up and ran it in for a touchdown, making it a 9 or 10 point margin, which definitely does affect the line. Except the USC team was so excited it ran onto the field, and they called a penalty, nullifying the touchdown. So the final score was back to 17-14. Pay the people who bet on Utah. At least if you got to the sports books right away. 2 hours later, the league commissioner ruled that the officials goofed when they nullified the touchdown, and so they changed the score 2 hours after the game ended. So now it is 23-14. And if you collected early on Utah, you got to keep your money. If you bet on SC, threw the tickets away, you were SOL. But if you could find your ticket, you might be able to collect it depending on which sports book you bet at. If you bet at MGM Grand, tough luck, Charlie. They were paying Utah, end of story. If you were betting at certain other casinos, they paid the SC tickets. A few casinos actually paid both sides.
I think that's actually the smart business move. Is to pay both sides. I mean, to try to keep your customers happy. Most Las Vegas casinos seem to fail in that regard in most cases, but the ones that are paying both sides, I think, are doing the right thing.
Well, I don't know how much money was on that game. It's SC is a Los Angeles school, and there's a lot of Los Angeles money bet on in Vegas. And so paying both sides could have been hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars. But I don't know. I don't know how big it was. Sometimes doing the right thing is easy if it's only going to cost you a few hundred dollars. And it's a lot harder if it's going to cost you a few hundred thousand. So, anyway, Michael Koenig was a sports bettor. And maybe we can ask him about that. He lives in L.A. I'm sure he's heard about that game.
Yeah, I'm sure he's very aware of. I, who don't really follow sports, was aware of that whole controversy.
All right. So when Munchkin and I were talking back and forth about what to do on the show today, he asked me, we're talking about what I should do in the dancer's answer section of the show.
Yeah, I have a question for you, because people approach me all the time wanting to know about learning to play blackjack, learning to count cards. So for blackjack players, it's very easy. Everybody has to learn basic strategy.
Right.
Before you can do anything, you learn basic strategy. So I'm wondering, if somebody wants to learn video poker, is there a first game equivalent? Is there something that you learn first for all video poker players?
Kind of the one thing to get you started at video poker.
Right.
Okay, here it is. Listen up. There is one thing, and that is, there is no one thing. To have a chance at video poker, you need to learn which game to play, at which casinos, and it varies by denomination and casino. You have to learn how to play that game. Then you have to figure out about the slot club and promotions and using them to your benefits. Getting one of those things right and the rest of them wrong isn't going to help you very much. And there is no one-size-fits-all answer. Now, if I had to narrow it down, I'd say get a good beginner's book and some software to practice with. Now, I sell these things on BobDanCirca.com, of course, and there are other authors who sell good products. Dan Paymar and Gene Scott have products that you can trust in both software and beginner's book. Make it a point to stay away from things written by Rob Singer. His techniques are mathematically unsound. Reading through a beginner's book will get you started. Once you've figured out what game to play, practicing on a computer will at least keep you from making the biggest mistakes. At that point, you need to make a decision. If you're enjoying the studying process, there's a lot more to read and there's a lot more to study, and you can get going. If you don't like the studying process or you don't like the game, then I suggest you give up video poker and take up bowling, because you're not going to succeed at it. It's going to require a lot of study, but it is still possible to make a living playing video poker, and it's not as easy as it used to be. But at the same time, I'm not sure it's harder. The tools are more readily available now, insofar as the software, as the information sources.
And but let's say that I live in St. Louis, because
okay.
I've gone in, to casinos, and I look at the video poker, and there's like 20 different games and all these different pay tables. Is there a way, if let's say I lived in St. Louis and I go to my local Harrah's,
okay,
and I look at all these games, do I have to write down all the pay tables, or is there a, like in blackjack, there are various forums where people exchange this information. Is there a forum that would tell me, oh, if you live in St. Louis, look for this pay table on this particular game?
Yes, there is. And there is a website. It's VP Free 2. That's VP as in video poker, FREE, and the number 2.com. That lists every casino in the country, or every sizable casino anyway, and their best games. Sometimes it says nothing very good. And it'll get you started. Now, this website is maintained by volunteers, and some volunteers are more knowledgeable than others. Some of the volunteers are going to keep secrets because they don't want the world to know about their favorite machine, etc. But as a place to start, it will tell you in which casino, which games. And so if you're a quarter player, you look for these particular games. If you're a dollar player or a $5 player, you look for those. So that'll tell you which games to go for.
Very good.
CTRs and STRs. You used to be a blackjack pit critter.
It's true. Although, fortunately for me, when I was a dealer and a pit critter, we didn't have any of this paperwork to deal with. But most of this really is handled by the cashier's cage. So a CTR is a cash transaction report.
Uh-huh.
And this is any time there is a cash transaction of more than $10,000. Whether it is you buy in on a table game for more than $10,000 during a 24-hour period, or you cash out at the cashier's cage, or you get a machine pay where they're going to, you know, pay you in cash. It's anytime there is a cash transaction of more than $10,000. Some people get confused by this because you could win. First of all, you could lose. You could buy in for $15,000, and they would fill out a cash transaction report.
Okay.
And now you could go and cash out $11,000 because you lost $4,000, and they would fill out another cash transaction report. Once the casino has your information in their database, they will never tell you that they're even filling these things out. In fact, they're not supposed to tell you that they're filling them out. But if your information is not in their database, then when you reach that $10,000 threshold, they have to ask for your ID and your Social Security number. And they won't tell you why. They'll just tell you they have to fill out some paperwork. Now, a suspicious transaction report, they fill out. Basically, they can fill it out anytime they're suspicious of a transaction, but I think they have to fill one out over any transaction over $3,000. But I don't think they need your information for that. They can say man in the brown shirt with a mustache.
Mm-hmm. That wouldn't be me. I have a lavender shirt on tonight and freshly shaven. Okay, so what generally would make them suspicious?
Well, I had an uncle who was on a board of directors of a bank, and he told me that at the bank, you could have a guy who comes in with $5,000 or $10,000 worth of cash all the time. He owns a business. He brings in his receipts at the end of the day. They wouldn't think that that's suspicious at all. But you could have another person who has a weekly paycheck that comes in and deposits their check, and that one day the guy shows up with $1,000 in cash. They could decide that's suspicious. So it's not the amount, it's just whether they think it's suspicious or not. Now, the casinos, of course, hate these things because they're just a big nuisance. But a person who worked in the cage, one time I asked them, when does your 24-hour clock reset? Because each casino starts their 24-hour day at a particular time. Say
like
it's 2 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, 2 or 3 or 6 or something, yeah.
Something like that. So if I got in $9,000 and now it goes past 2 o'clock, I now have another $10,000 I can get in without them having to fill out a CTR. The person in the cage told me that just my asking for the information of when the 24-hour day started, they were supposed to fill out a suspicious transaction. Just the fact that I wanted to know this. So, but here's the important thing. People shouldn't get that worried about CTRs. They are not tax forms. They do not go to the IRS. They go apparently to the Treasury Department.
Like Homeland Security or the Drug Enforcement to see if you're laundering money. Is that the purpose for it, to check?
That is the purpose, is to see if you're laundering money. Now, my understanding is it's basically a huge pipe where millions of these things are getting submitted every day, and nobody really looks at it unless they're already investigating somebody. And then they plug their name into computers and say, has this person been filing a bunch of CTRs? But the more important thing is people do something illegal to try to avoid these CTRs, and this is what they shouldn't be doing, and that's called structuring.
Structuring.
So let's say you have $15,000 worth of chips, and you say to yourself, I don't want to trigger a CTR. I'm going to go cash out $9,900. Well, that is you are structuring your cash outs to avoid the CTR, and that is a crime. So that is something people don't want to do.
So,
now, there are a lot of table game players who do not want the casino to have their name and their information, so they stop buying in. If they get up to $9,000, they have to stop playing. This is why a lot of table games players keep chips for the casinos that they play at, so they don't have to worry about these things, and why when they win, they don't go to the cashier's cage and cash out. They just leave. So it's better to leave with all your chips than it is to go and cash out some of them. Because if you're cashing out less than 10,000 and you have more than 10,000, you're structuring. But if you just leave with all of them, you're not doing anything.
And
wrong.
If you come in the next day and you only have 9,000 in your pocket the next day, that's not structuring.
Well, you'd be much better off keeping your cash outs to under $2,500 at a time.
Under $2,500.
Yeah.
There's we haven't talked about that 2,500 rule. Is that a different report?
Well, every casino has their own rules about when they will ask for ID to cash out.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them, if you're under $2,500, you don't have to give them any kind of ID or player's card or anything like that. So
at Silverton, if it's $1,200,
Coast properties, you have to, you know, any $500 chip they call the pit about at the Coast properties. So,
well,
yeah, different places are different, but
good.
I remember at the Barbary Coast in the old days, three black chips they would call the pit to tell them that you were cashing out $300.
How did they ever let you get three black chips at Barbary Coast without kicking you out first?
Barbary Coast was a great place for us to play for a long time.
All right, so we got good news. Michael Koenig is on the air, on the line. So, Richard, why don't you introduce us to Michael, and let's talk to him.
Okay, Michael is a Renaissance man. He's an actor, a singer, a recording artist, a record producer, but mostly he is a writer, and he's written 7 books, and some of them about gambling, and those are the ones we're going to talk about tonight. So, Michael Koenig, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Munchkin, great to hear your voice again. Hello, Bob. Great to speak with you again as well.
Welcome back. We didn't scare you away the first time. This is good.
You guys are some of the smartest guys in the whole gambling world. It's a pleasure to talk with you.
Well,
buttering up the host. It'll get you everywhere.
I think that's a smart idea. Just don't stop now. Okay, so specifically we're going to talk about The Man with the $100,000 Breast, which is a book of short stories all related to gambling somehow. So, but the title story is fascinating. We've been talking about that, so people go, what the heck's all that about? So what's that story about, Michael?
It's about a guy who got breast implants to win a $100,000 wager. And the irony of the whole thing is that it was expected, if he was brave and courageous and insane enough to actually keep these things for a year, on the 366th day, he would collect his $100,000 and go to the nearest plastic surgeon and get them taken out. As we find out in the book, Brian Zembic, the degenerate gambler who got the breasts in the first place, never took him out.
So they're still in. This is like 12 years ago? Something like that?
Yeah, something like that.
All right. So,
and there is a picture in the book to prove that this is not an apocryphal.
Yeah, they are good size of things. In the story, though, the part that I enjoyed the most was actually when you met Brian. You met him in a bathroom. He was trying to win a wager of, if he stayed in that bathroom for 30 days, he would collect $14,000 from some other degenerate gamblers.
Yeah.
And he was determined to win that. And then the gamblers just would send in their buddies to use the bathroom. And now, I used to hang out at a backgammon club, and I could just imagine them saying, you know, oh, there's a new garlic cafe. Why don't you order extra garlic and then go talk to Brian and see what happens?
Yeah.
Now, I laughed a lot when I read that. Anything you can tell us about that that wasn't in the book?
Well, just that I feel you and Munchkin just must be awfully proud to be part of that world.
All right.
These are the people that give gambling a good name.
Oh dear, he's disassociating himself from the gamblers.
Michael, are you still in touch with Brian?
I am not, which is a shame because, man, every other week I get some email from somewhere around the world, some television show or movie producer or whatever, trying to get in touch with Brian Zembic. They all want to talk with him still.
You know, he one of the things that I found pretty amazing was he got married about 10 years ago, and yeah. You would have thought that he would have, you know, maybe taken them out before he got married, but no, I mean, you know, he's, and now he has a 9-year-old daughter who, you know, is quite a piano prodigy, and I would love to know actually what his daughter, how his daughter feels about, you know, his having breasts.
You think she would need psychiatric treatment?
Yeah, I don't know.
It's a strange situation, Bob, but the underlying point of the story is that most of the cats involved in this world are just a little bit off and a little bit different from regular people, honest working people. I mean, cats who can wager thousands of dollars on, you know, which raindrop is going to get to the bottom of the window pane first. These are not well people.
Uh-huh. Well, also, just the idea that to spend 30 days, 24 hours a day in a bathroom for 30 days, you have to have no life to be able to do that.
It's solitary confinement. Yeah, in fact, it's not solitary, but it is a type of confinement, exactly. And the point I was trying to hammer home in that chapter, Bob, was that these guys, especially Brian, have tremendous skills. That he was a very accomplished backgammon player, a world-class sleight-of-hand magician, also a very accomplished blackjack player, and a okay poker player. He had all these developed skills, but he came from an ethos that the way he looked at life was anything to actually avoid doing something that in any way resembled work. And so if it meant just sitting in a bathtub for a month, that's the route he chose to go.
Wow.
Yeah, fascinating, a little bit skewed and weird, but that's why it's fun to read about rather than actually be that person.
Now, one of the other stories in the book was called The Cold Deck Crew. And in this, you described a team of players who swindle a casino out of $250,000 in a somewhat different way than we've seen in movies on TV. The swindle included a prearranged fight breaking out to distract casino employees once a certain kind of a switch was taking place. Now, I don't know why they didn't have an attractive young lady with revealing clothing distracting the pit, but as a former pit critter, Munchkin could tell you which kind of distraction he would have preferred. But you called the leader of the gang of swindlers Mickey Swift, whatever his real name was. There must have been a number of possibilities, scams, that Mickey did that you could have written about. How did you pick this particular one?
This one was actually part of the public record. This particular con that they pulled was successful many times in many different places, but they did in fact eventually get caught. There were many members in this team. It took close to 12 people to make the whole thing happen, and one of the members of the team the next day after a big score, you know, went out and bought a $28,000 motorcycle and started talking about what they pulled off, and they did get busted. The fact that it was in the public record, albeit under different names, and the crime was known, Mickey was comfortable talking on background how they actually did what they did.
Mm-hmm. Did he serve prison time?
He did indeed. Yep.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, you know, the Casino Commission does not look kindly upon cheaters.
No. No.
Mr. Munchkin, care to weigh in on that?
Well, no, I you're right, and they try to make an example when they actually do catch somebody, which is really pretty rare. They do want to make an example of them if they can, you know, to deter other people. They're just not very good at catching it in the first place. But
yeah, and you're right. They catch very few of these cats. Mickey was under the impression they could have done this pretty much uninterrupted without any problem, if not for the loose lips. Like the move itself and the gaffe itself was so well done, it was virtually indetectable, almost like we regular amateur people can't detect the move of a very accomplished sleight of hand magician.
Right.
That's how good the move was.
Actually, there was a Vietnamese crew that got busted just last year. They'd been doing this in Baccarat for quite a few years. Not quite as sophisticated as, you know, the ones in the book, but they had taken millions and millions of dollars before they were finally pulled up.
And what was it that tripped them up?
You know, they were all, I think they were all Vietnamese, and at some point the FBI got onto them, but I'm not sure what tipped them off.
So now we've mentioned a bunch, and you got to look it up this week and tell our listeners next week what all happened.
Okay, I'll get all the details on that crew, yeah, but it was millions and millions of dollars, but a very...
Yeah, I guess the only thing that would have tripped them up, the only thing that would have caught the FBI's attention, not the fact that there were a bunch of Vietnamese guys playing Highland Baccarat, that's all normal, the fact that they were winning, that will catch their attention.
It was also the dealer who performed the false shuffle was always Vietnamese, too.
Ah, right.
So,
there you go.
Yeah, and it was, you know, all throughout the West, from California up into Canada, apparently. So I wanted to ask you, a lot of these stories came, you were the gambling writer for Cigar Aficionado magazine. And I'm curious, were you an advantage player before you started writing about it, or did writing about it really kind of draw you into that world and get you playing?
That's a great question. They seem to dovetail, so I think there was some overlap there. I had already done a number of things before I started writing the gambling column for Cigar Aficionado, but I did a lot more during and when I stopped. And it actually got to a point where I remember having a conversation with the editor there saying I pretty much would have to choose which route I wanted to go. And it was, you know, as someone who's been involved in these things most of his life, Munchkin, you know that anytime you're doing advantage plays, again, they're totally legal. There's nothing unethical or illegal about them. But anytime you are doing that kind of thing, the less attention you draw to yourself, the better. And it wasn't helping to have, you know, guys being able to look up articles I've written in national magazines about beating the casino.
Yeah, you talked about that a lot in your Smart Money book, where you... The guys running the sports book would read your articles, and you go, well, yeah, but I'm a stupid gambler, and so let me get down 50,000.
half sharp. That was my persona.
Half sharp. Okay. Now, actually, the story I enjoyed most, I found on a personal basis, was one you called "Shaking Down the Sheiks," which is a bunch of poker players in Egypt who were hanging out waiting for these rich Arabs to come by and want to play poker. And they weren't interested in any kind of sightseeing or anything else. The only reason they were there is for these Arabs, who may or may not show up. And it reminds me a whole lot of hanging out at backgammon clubs, which is where I met Munchkin. And I mean, when I was hanging out there, we didn't know any of the minor things in the world, like Watergate or, you know, the fall of Saigon. None of those minor things did we have any knowledge of, because we were just waiting for fish to come walking into the backgammon club. So,
man,
I love...
Bob, I'll never forget floating down the Nile. The Nile, one of the birthplaces of civilization, and we're going to Luxor, the real one, not the one in Vegas. We're going to Luxor, and we're, you know, some of the most iconic monuments, and they're all floating past us as we're going down the Nile, and I'm looking around, and 90% of the people from the traveling poker group are playing Chinese poker in the lounge. Can't even be bothered to go up to the deck.
Yeah, it's just a lousy pyramid you're going by. Nothing yeah. Major.
Oh man.
You had a story called 1-900-NFL-SCAM.
Yeah, right.
Where this guy would be selling his picks. And some of them were made by his 4-year-old son. And he would have a guarantee that if you lost this week in his guaranteed picks, you would get the playoff picks for free.
Absolutely free.
Also made by his 4-year-old son. But, and so, you know, I hear these, you know, on Saturday morning or something on the ESPN radio stations. You know, you listen to these guys and it sounds like, you know, the sports book must be hemorrhaging money because these guys are
hemorrhaging, you know, man. I don't know how they stay in business.
90% winners or whatever it is, you know, and it and it's just like, then you read your story and, you know, 4-year-old kid is picking it. Do you have any idea how common that is?
I think it's extraordinarily common because one of the key lessons I learned in my years with the Brain Trust and then with the Hollywood Boys and just basically living sports betting for a number of years of my life, one of the key lessons is this. The very few people who really, truly can consistently beat the number, they have no interest in selling their picks. They want to either bet them themselves or get mobbed up with, sorry, that wasn't a good word, get hooked up with a syndicate that has enough capital to leverage their information and bet more than they might be able to bet on their own. But selling them, that's just the triumph of marketing, and I am not going to say that those guys don't know anything about sports. But I will say that those guys know nothing about betting on sports compared to the guys who really bet on sports for a living.
Yeah. I mean, of course, why would they sell it if they actually could win? I mean, yeah, it doesn't. It's just amazing that people are gullible enough to keep buying those things.
Yeah, and the lesson that Bob mentioned from 900 NFL Scam, this guy was so brazen. He said, of course I give half my customers the favorite and I give half the customers the dog, because next week I know half my customers are going to think I'm a genius and they're going to be happy, and the other half with successful marketing will think he can't be wrong 2 weeks in a row.
Right.
Go figure.
So are you still gambling with an edge? And if not, do you miss it?
I'm not gambling with an edge. I'm not gambling at all. And I miss the thrill of winning. I miss the thrill of beating a game that most people can't beat. I miss the quasi-Robin Hood aspect of being able to beat the man. Mm-hmm. When the man is normally crushing everybody else.
And the man sets the rules.
And the man sets the rules, and as long as you play by them, if you can figure out a way within his rules to beat them, you feel like a pretty sharp guy. But so I do miss that stuff. However, the whole world of dealing with bookmakers and the kind of people who are in the business and in the industry, it took its toll on me psychically, emotionally, spiritually, and I have subsequently filled that hole with music and art and things like that, but I still...
And a wife?
Maintain, yeah, and a wife, and and a life, and but I still maintain a fascination with the numbers. I don't watch the Don Best screen, but I am vaguely aware of who's favored by what, and I'm vaguely aware of interesting things going on, but I have no desire to get back into it.
Before you got on the air tonight, we were talking a little bit about the USC Utah football.
Now that's an interesting one. Yeah,
it's like, had you been betting, and so whether or not you got paid depend on which casino you laid the bet at. That would have been an interesting situation.
Especially with the amount of money that we were betting back then, it certainly would have been.
Well, yeah, the casino might have made the rule as to which way they were going to go, partly based on the size of your bet.
Exactly. That's how they usually made most of their decisions, Bob.
It would not have been in your favor, huh?
Probably not.
So, you know, people laugh, Michael, when I say that I gave up show business for the reliable income of professional gambling. So I'm wondering what your experience in Hollywood is compared to your gambling world, the Hollywood world compared to the gambling world.
Oh, I think your description is perfect, Munchkin. The gambling is a much more reliable return. You know what your expected return is, and if you have enough trials, it usually hits that number. I don't know how anything happens in Hollywood. I've lived here for close to 20 years, and I have no idea how it works. I don't know how anything ever gets made. I just know that people live and work here, and the machine keeps churning.
Interesting. You and Munchkin, in his book, write about the same guys. You both write about Max Rubin. You both write about Mike Sabatini, although you call him a couple different names in your stories, although even he was the guy who lost the $100,000 bet, although in the book you call him different, but since he outed himself in Munchkin's book, I guess we could say that that was Sabatini. I don't know if you're going to confirm that or not, but it doesn't matter. But you guys picked out, you wrote about the same guys. I guess they were just so colorful that you just couldn't resist them.
Man, a good story is a good story, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, right. A good story is a good story. Although, I mean, there were a few people that we wrote about, but of course, Michael's a lot more prolific than I am. So he, you know, he's covered. You know, when you're writing about gambling all the time, you cover everybody eventually, I guess.
Yeah,
I am envious that you got to interview Johnny Moss, you know, before he died. Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah, and I was very young then. I didn't really have that much perspective on history. I was just sort of learning the history as I went along, and now that I look back, I realize some of the cats that I got to get close with and hear their stories were people that will go down in the sort of pantheon of this weird subculture.
Yeah, absolutely.
One of your stories was Out of the Oscars Into the Pan, where you describe playing in a Los Angeles area card club, the game of Pan. And it seemed like that night most of your hands were pissers and you got peckered a lot and you never got to go out on a bong. It sounds like a really tough night. Did you ever go back and play Pan some more?
Man, until you mentioned all those things, Bob, I had forgotten even what the rules were of Pan. I was like, what the hell is that game again? No, I've never played since. Well, you guys probably know more about that game than I do. Is it possible to even gain an advantage in that game? Is it purely just card distribution, or is there some skill involved?
I've never played the game, so I have no idea. Well, there must be some skill because they managed to fleece you. The little old ladies managed to.
Oh man, yeah. Bob, have you ever played that game?
I haven't. cards are, I mean, I tried backgammon, and when competing against other people doesn't seem to be my skill set. Competing against machines where everything is, I can memorize the rules and do well. I've done well at that. But competing against a moving target has been beyond my skill set, so.
And where I grew up, the old ladies played Mahjong instead of Pan, so.
Yeah, my grandmother too, yes.
Yeah.
I can never beat her at that either.
Alrighty. So, last question. Let's a little bit more about Max Rubin. He's scoring his comps. You talk about him lying through his teeth to get fight tickets and then teaching you how to pad your score at the Lady Luck Casino to he is so colorful and it works, and I suppose you can use those things in other parts of life as well other than gambling.
I suppose you can, but I don't advocate it. And I think the only reason why I felt comfortable doing this was because the so-called victims of the techniques that Max taught us are casinos. And I just don't feel bad about doing just about anything when it involves separating a casino and their money. But outside the casino, I do have ethical problems with it. Some might say you shouldn't feel that bad about doing the same to a bank. That's another discussion.
Maybe the telephone company. Okay.
Yeah, so. That kind of thing. But in general, you know, Max's techniques basically are to play an elaborate charade and at all times be giving the casino a false impression of the quantity and quality of your action. And it's true. It does work. I just
like all technique. It's not as easy as it used to be. You know, the casinos have become much more sophisticated about it. But
I think since his book came out, he sort of spilled a lot of the secrets with the book. I mean, anybody could read it, and
right.
Certainly people on the casino side had to read it, right, Munch?
Oh yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
We're gonna
I heard a story about the CEO of Caesar's Palace coming down and saying, you know, holding Max's book in his hand, saying, "This is the most important gambling book written in the last 20 years.
Hey, man, put that on the cover blurb.
That's it.
Yeah. Because, you know, yeah, the casinos realized how much money they were losing to people who were reading Max's book.
Yeah.
Michael, we're going to have to let you go. And we're going to want you back another 4 or 6 months talking about your book, Telling Lies and Getting Paid, which talks a lot about your poker career. So we'll let you visit that career. And when you come on again, we hope you're willing to come back again.
It would be my pleasure.
Our pleasure as well. Thank you very much, Michael Koenig.
Thank you, Michael.
Well, Munch, what did we learn? It's possible to give up gambling and live happily ever after.
Boy, I just don't think I could do it. Go ahead.
Well, most of the people I know who were gambling years ago are either still gambling or dead.
Yeah.
And you just people even the advantage gamblers, and so we all say, no, we're not addicted to this, but it's what we enjoy doing, and
yeah, it is, and you know, I mean, if I were to hit the lotto, I don't play the lotto, but if I were to, you know, have a windfall of $100 million or something, I would still be out. I'm sorry, I'd still be out there trying to gamble with an edge.
Well. If that's the way you are, I'm going to do some commercials.
Okay.
The South Point has more than 10,000 games, returning more than 99%. This is more than any other casino in the world. On October 2nd, which is a Sunday, videopoker.com, which is also one of our sponsors, and the South Point are joining forces to offer a video poker tournament. This is a $50 entry fee where all your money is returned. One of the benefits you get is before the tournament, I will be teaching a class on how to do well in a video poker tournament. So whether you're in the tournament or not, you're welcome to come by to the class. It'll be probably about 11 o'clock in the morning on Sunday, October 2nd. We'll, as we get closer and get a firm date, I will let you know. But it's a speed tournament. If you're a pretty fast player, you're going to have positive equity. So go to videopoker.com/event, and you'll see the invitation. So anybody can join, even on the day of the tournament. You need to become a member of videopoker.com, but that's free to do. So that's October 2nd. This coming Wednesday, the free video poker class at the South Point will be 9-6 double-double bonus quick quads. The word quad in the name quick quads refers to four of a kinds. When you get a three of a kind and the other two cards add up to the rank of the three of a kind, you get paid for four of a kind. What I mean is 5-5-5-3-2 gets paid for four fives because the three and the two adds up to five. Or 3-3-3-2-ace gets paid for four threes. So you're going to get a lot more quads than usual. And so they charge you six coins per line instead of five to make the math work out right. The range at the South Point is a quarter triple play is the smallest game. That's a bet of $4.50. And they go up to $1.10 play, which requires a bet of $60. So if somewhere in that range is comfortable for you, this is an excellent game to play. It's 99.65%. And you start adding in the slot club and the double points and the other promotions and the mailers, it's like it's an advantage game. The strategy is similar to double-double bonus, but there are some significant differences. The class starts at 1 o'clock in the Grandview Lounge, and it's free to everybody at least 21 years old at the Palms. We've been talking about their Choose Your Destiny drawings for a couple weeks now. If you're selected, you get a guaranteed $1,500, or you get to play a game where the average score is 1667. Munchkin and I recommend you gamble it up and play the game for the higher average. And so far, most of the people playing the game are not taking our advice. So I'll be competing in that this weekend. I've played a lot this week. And so if I get called, I promise to gamble it up. On their PEW, Play, Earn, and Win, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, the big prizes are a 15.6-inch backlit LED television. So you pay, it costs 35,000 points, which you get to keep. Now, I looked it up online, and you can buy those TVs for $89, with $35,000.
$89
is what it says. That's the best price. You can pay $169 at other places if you want, your choice. But so with $89, it makes it a quarter percent bonus, so equivalent to double points at the Palms. Although I guess if you want to pay $169 in another place, it could make it triple points. Wouldn't that be a good deal? So there's that, and there's other gifts as well. And it's up to like almost 80,000 points to get all the gifts. At the M, which promotion is going on depends on what day it is. On Mondays in September, they have a mystery multiplier, 1x, 2x, or 3x points for video poker, up to 10x for slots. You have to go down there and find out what it is. Most players seem to be getting at least one 3x multiplier on one Monday, but they're not sure which Monday it is until they get there. The multiplier is good between 4 a.m. to 3:59 a.m. on Tuesday. Wednesdays, they have a senior slot tournament. If you play at least 500 points in the previous week, you win. They also have a lotto drawing, where you pick five numbers out of 49, and you can earn up to five tickets on the day of the play on Wednesday, $250 per ticket. And they're going to draw numbers, and if they get a winner, it's $5,000. If they don't get a winner, then everybody who matches at least two, the first two or the last two, gets $100. So the drawing is at 7, and be there or miss out. On Fridays, they have hot seat drawings at 4, 6, 8, and 10 p.m. Each drawing, 10 winners receive a total of $3,600 in prizes, and another 10 winners get $125 at Anthony's Steakhouse or $100 at Marnelli's Italian restaurant. To be eligible to win, you must have played 250 points sometime during the day. This is a low roller tournament, or low roller event, because 250 points does not require much. Those of you who want an edge but don't play a lot, that's good. Here's an opportunity. Also this weekend, they're having an invitational slot tournament. I will be there. Not that that's an extra attraction, I suppose. If you play, you get invited to these things. It's a little bit extra EV. It's not huge prizes, but it's positive equity. And so I will be there. Good. So those are our sponsors. Who do we got next week?
Next week we have Steve Sear, who calls himself the Super Host. He is the subject of the book Whale Hunt in the Desert, and we'll be talking to him about whether advantage players have use of a super host, and what can a super host do for us that just calling up the regular host can't do. And
how big do we have to play to get to a super host? If we're a quarter player, forget about it.
And whether he should know whether we're an advantage player or not. Maybe he's don't ask, don't tell in that regard. So all kinds of questions about what hosts can do for us and what we can do to get them to give us more stuff. And anybody who has questions can submit them to Bob or I during the week, and we'll be sure to ask Steve when he's here with us next week.
Yeah, gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. is a good place to send the questions. One I got today about when we talk to a host that I will be asking Steve is, does the host care where we got the money? So if we got it because we are a arms dealer or a drug trafficker or a mobbed up or something, do they care? And okay, good. So the week after that, we have a return visit.
Right. Week after that, Bob Nersessian is back.
Bob Nersessian is player's lawyer. We've gotten more comments on Bob Nersessian's visit than any of the other shows. We asked him all sorts of questions about, you know, can the casinos do this and do they beat people up and stuff like that. I just finished reading Busting Vegas, which is a book that Andy Block talked about a couple weeks ago. They're backroomed in that book and beaten up a little bit. And I kind of want to ask Nersessian, do they still do that anymore? I don't think they do, but I might be wrong.
Yeah, I haven't heard of anybody getting roughed up in quite a while.
Which is good.
Yes, that's good.
Which is good. All right, so we got one more minute. And finally, in the following week, we have a guest. And I actually, he gave us a pseudonym, so I don't remember what the pseudonym is. He is a video poker player, an advantage video poker player who hangs out mainly in Atlantic City. So he's going to be talking about advantage plays in Atlantic City, and he also travels around the country. But I would have thought that we would have had more video poker players on here, given that those are the people I know, but somehow we haven't had a lot of those.
We're due.
We're due, and we're gonna fulfill that due.
It's good that we have somebody from the East Coast too to get, so we're not quite so Vegas centric.
All right. So we got about 5 seconds left. I want everybody to go out and hit several royal flushes this week.
You've been listening to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard W. Munchkin. Archived versions of past shows may be found on bobdancer.com and richardmunchkin.com. We welcome emails at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. Bob Dancer and Richard W. Munchkin are both on Facebook and welcome your input or questions. The sponsors for the show are the South Point Hotel, Casino, and Spa, the M Resort, the Palms Casino Resort, and the website videopoker.com. Join us again next week for another Gambling with an Edge.